then you have to tell me the place. Now, the reason I did that instead of having you memorize that entire list is because there are 37 places where hardly anything happens at all. There's just a name there and a passage. And it's really pointless to memorize all that. And the names are tough. I still think it's a contest in phonetics or an endurance run in phonetics to be able to try and pronounce those and to memorize them. So I just decided that it would be a lot better for you, and it'd be more fruitful for you to do that. Now, on these 15 short answer questions, they incorporate that it covers Genesis through Deuteronomy. Now, let me say this. I will not ask you any specifics. Now, I won't ask you, name the 12 sons of Jacob. You should really be able to answer those questions with just without ever studying. If you've got anything out of the class, but that's really what I want to know is what did you get out of the class? Because they're not really the type of questions that you can study for. You just either know them or you don't. Now you can study some. It would be good to go back and review things that I have stressed. Anything I have stressed, you've got to know. If I've really stressed it. So, I really think that's about it on this test. Anybody have a question? The final question on the test reads this, thus, have you read the entire Pentateuch? 8 points possible. You cannot pass the class unless this is answered affirmatively. Parenthesis. Make a 92 on the test and fail the class. Well, it's worth 8 so I can get 100 points in the test. But you have to have read it. So if you have not read it, if you take the test if you want to and then go back and read it, I'd advise that you read it before you took the test, though. It'd help. But make sure that you have read it. Okay? How many of you read your books, the book Old Testament History by Hester? Okay?
The Heart of Hebrew History.
All right. Old Testament History is by Smith. That's Sunday morning. Heart of Hebrew History by Hester. I'm sorry. Okay, it'd be a good idea maybe sometime since you bought the book, read it. it goes on to next semester. So what I would suggest is this summer, in those cool evenings as you're sitting there with that glass of iced tea and your feet are propped up, drag that book out and read it. And it will help you, it will be a good review for this class and a good foretaste of the class that is to come, to use the scriptural terminology. If you've read McGarvey in 4 Corinthians. I forgot to mention that. That's right. You put that down on your test if you've read it. All right. Anybody have a question or comment? I have papers from everybody in here, don't I? Okay. Can you get your paper to me by Sunday? Okay, good. All right. Yeah, right here. Okay, some of you are as verbose as your teacher. I see I'm going to pay a price for it. I'm going to read them all now. Okie doke, Deuteronomy chapter 23. Tonight we finish. The 23rd chapter is within this great second speech. Now, I've been telling you all along that Deuteronomy consists of 4 long speeches. Really, that's incorrect. See, I tell you the last night. You've got to make all these things right. There are 4 speeches, but it's a little bit misleading to tell you to say it the way that I have. I should have said there are 3 speeches with some following events. Now, one of those events involves a speech. But 3 major speeches, okay? And that's on your outline that you've been handed out tonight. And I just call the 4th main section the final events. in this third address, the subject, or the second address, the subject is the law of God. Do you remember in chapter 5 through 11, he took up the Decalogue? What's the Decalogue? Ten Commandments. Decalogue. The log, the book, or the commandments, and the deck of the ten. Then in chapters 12 through 26, it's the law in detail, an exposition of the principal laws. We have dealt with 10 subpoints underneath that section. Chapter 23 is number 11, and chapter 23 deals with the rights of citizenship within the congregation. In verses 1 through 8, certain people are to be excluded. He that is wounded in the stones or hath his privy member cut off shall not enter into the assembly of Jehovah. All right? A male whose genitals have been injured. A bastard shall not enter into the assembly of Jehovah. Even to the tenth generation shall none of his enter into the assembly of Jehovah. An illegitimate child. Again, an Ammonite or a Moabite. Now notice, these cannot enter into the tenth generation. The reason is given in verse 4. They hired against thee Balaam, the son of Beor. And then a little summary of Balaam's activities. In verses 7 through 8, some are included, however. Thou shalt not abhor an Edomite, for he is thy brother. Where does he come from?
Esau.
Edom is what? Red. All right, Esau was red. Thou shalt not abhor an Egyptian, because thou wast a sojourner in his land. The children of the third generation that are born unto them shall enter into the assembly of Jehovah. So in the third generation, which would be what? You've got a man who becomes a father, and a grandfather. I guess it would be the grandfather would be the third generation, or it would be either the grandson or the great-grandson, depending on how you counted it. One of those two. With the others, with the Ammonites or the Moabites, not even under the tenth. So they're excluded entirely. Beginning with verse 9, continuing through verse 14, there are instructions given concerning purity of the camp during the time of war. Now, these are given in detail, and you might not have been aware of some of these things before. Verse 10, if there be among you any man that is not clean by reason of that which chanceth him by night, then he shall go abroad out of the camp. I'm not sure what that means, but I think it means if he cannot restrain his bladder during the night. Then in verse 12, concerning excretions, human excretions, and verse 13, the instructions, and verse 14, those instructions. So to the detailed, and the idea is to keep things clean, to denote the distinctness of Israel. Then in verses 15 through 25, these various rites are described. Verses 15 and 16, the escaped slave. Thou shalt not deliver unto a master a servant that escaped from his master unto thee. He shall dwell with thee in the midst of thee, in the place which he shall choose within one of thy gates, where it pleaseth him best. Thou shalt not depress him. Verses 17 through 18, the prostitute and the sodomite are to be condemned. One of the things just burns me up right now is the gay movement in America and people that tolerate it. I heard Vicki Hightower on the radio, you know, defending the civil rights of the gays. I'm not suggesting this haphazardly. As far as I'm concerned, what needs to be done is they need to take them out and line them up and shoot them down and plow them in a trench. And that's exactly what needs to be done to them. Well, I think a Christian has to be involved as much as they can. It's hard. The question arises, when do you stop serving God and start serving simply your society? That's the only question of the line where I have now. I think that a Christian, certainly Christians, should make their voices heard. And we have a voice and need to make it heard. And I would encourage, personally, I would encourage anybody to take an active part in against those things. One illustration of that was my own father was involved in a pornography or an anti-pornography movement in Idaho. I think I still got some of the newspaper clippings, you know. Guys would write letters about him, and he'd write letters back about them, answer them, in the paper, and they kind of had a running feud going for a while. But anyway, I think a Christian should become involved. The only question I have in my mind is sometimes it would be easy for a person to become so involved in that you could neglect some of your duties as a Christian. You become so engrossed in it. At least that would be a danger with me. So that's just one danger. Coming back then, verses 19 through 20, lending. You're to not lend with interest to your brother. Now, to a foreigner, you can, verse 20, but not to your brother. Next, vows, verses 21 through 23. When thou shalt vow a vow unto Jehovah thy God, thou shalt not be slack to pay it. When you give your word, you stand behind it. Now this is repeated. It's picked up again several times in the Old Testament. It's picked up in Psalm 15, the Zion dweller psalm, in which a man swears to his own hurt. It's picked up again in Ecclesiastes, when one does not take his vows unto Jehovah lightly or in vain. So it's a reoccurring thought. And what you're finding is because, basically, these are sermons. In fact, I'm thinking about preaching Sunday morning. I'm going to call it the final sermon and just preach Deuteronomy 27 through 30, which is Moses' final sermon. I've really been thinking about that. I'm not sure if I will. I may change my mind. But anyway, so what you have seeds being dropped that later will be expanded in some of the rest of Scripture. And you have the same thing in the New Testament. A lot of times you'll have a seed dropped in the Gospels, which is later expanded in the epistles. One of the most notable examples, just to give you an illustration, is Jesus said in John 17, in his high priestly prayer, glorify thou me with the glory which I had when I was with thee in the beginning. I don't know if that's word for word. All right, that's picked up and that's discussed in detail by Paul in Philippians 2, 1 through 11. So you have that same type of a process here with the prophets, with the Gospels and Paul and the other writers of the New Testament epistles. Coming back then, verses 24 through 25, deal with the eating from fields. And I think these laws are interesting. When thou comest into thy neighbor's vineyard, then thou mayest eat of the grapes till thy fill at thine own pleasure, but thou shalt not put any in thy vessel. Now you can stand there and eat until you're full, but you don't cut them and take them with you. The same thing has reference to the standing grain. You can pluck and you can eat in your hand, but you cannot take a sickle out there and start harvesting for yourself. You take them with your hand, but not with a sickle. So these are important laws, and this is going to come back up in a minute. Chapter 25, point number 13, or chapter 24, point number 12, excuse me. Let me skip a chapter. Regulations concerning divorce, the poor, and gleanings. The first four verses deal with divorce. When a man taketh a wife and marrieth her, then it shall be, if she find no favor in his eyes, because he hath found some unseemly thing in her, that he shall write her a bill of divorcement and shall give it in her hand and send her out of his house. Some have thought that this was a lenient law. Actually, I think it's been more correctly understood that the bill of divorcement is a requirement that is making the law more strict. Because if a man has to sit down and write it out and say, all right, I'm divorcing you for this reason. So then he's got to think about it. But he might otherwise just blow up in anger and say, get out of here. I don't want to ever see you again. And then send her off and that'd be it. All right, but this way, when you have to think about it, he might not be as prone to do it. The question has been raised, what is the unseemly thing in her? In the days of Jesus, there were two Jewish schools of thought. One was Shammai, and the other was Hillel. And you've heard me refer to these schools before in different classes. These schools took opposite positions, and I cannot remember which school took which position. So I'll just tell you the two different positions. One of them said, one of them's liberal, one of them's conservative. One of them said the unseemly thing had to refer to the fact that she had committed fornication before she was married. So that would make divorce limited. The other one said anything he didn't like. If he saw a woman that he thought was prettier, get rid of the first one. So you have the second one. Didn't like the way she cooked? Tough. It was a man's world, according to that school of thought. So he could give it to her and send her out of his house. Now, when she departed, she could go and be another man's wife. If the latter husband hated her and write her a bill of divorcement and give it in her hand and send her out of his house, or if the latter husband die, who took her to be his wife, her former husband who sent her away may not take her again to be his wife. After that, she is defiled, for that is abomination before Jehovah. Now, let me suggest a thought. And I'm only suggesting this as something that needs to be considered. In the marriage and divorce and remarriage question of today, it may be, a lot of times I've heard it said, if a man marries a woman, they're divorced for unscriptural grounds other than fornication or other than 1 Corinthians 7:15, which I believe to be also scriptural grounds for divorce. Or you're being divorced. The believer's being divorced. But anyway, for one of those two reasons, then, all right, they marry another. Then they become a Christian. All right? So now they want to make it right. So what are they going to do? So they have to leave the second mate and go back to the first mate. Well, now they have to leave the second mate because the second mate to remain in that would be to remain in a state of adultery. And they cannot do that. But the question I'm raising is, can they go back to the first one? If it was an abomination then, why would it be different today? In terms of the marital relationship. You see my point? Most cases it would be impossible to go back to the first one. Utterly impossible. I mean, it's not even a consideration. But even if it were a consideration, I don't think I could tell somebody, go back to your first mate after reading this passage. Now, if any of you have a thought on that, Minerva? All right. The principle of going back to the first husband would remain the same in the case of the woman. Well, anyway, you all might kick that over in your minds. I think it would be an interesting thing. I would like to do some more studying about that. In verse 5, here's something that my wife would have appreciated. When a man taketh a new wife, he shall not go out in the host, neither shall he be charged with any business. He shall be free at home 1 year, and shall cheer his wife whom he hath taken. I wouldn't have understood that till I got married. But wives do need to be cheered, the first wife of their marital life. They realize all of a sudden what they've got themselves into. somebody said, you shouldn't marry a woman until you can afford to take her hand out of her daddy's pocket. Well, sometimes there is quite a drastic realization that dawns upon a young woman at the point of marriage when it finally dawns on her that here she is and she's dependent upon this man for her support and her income. And she's to be with him for the rest of her life. Verse 6, pledges again. The millstone, or the upper millstone for a pledge. You can't take it. Verse 7 deals with a man in slavery. If a man's selling slavery, then you're to put him to death if he's selling your brethren. Verses 8 and 9, you're to remember and to keep the words of the Levites, or the priests, as they instruct you with regards to leprosy. Where do we read about leprosy? Good question to ask. Well, if it has to do with the Leviticus, or the Levites and the priests, it has to deal with Leviticus. It has to be in Leviticus. What chapters? Laws of uncleanness and purity are cleanness. 11 through 15. 11, unclean, clean animals. 12, woman after childbirth. 13, test of leprosy. 14, cleansing of leprosy. Get your minds in gear. Okay, verses 10 through 18. The poor. First of all, you're to treat a borrower properly in verses 10 through 13. You're not to go into his house and drag it out. Thou shalt not stand without, and the man to whom thou dost lend shall bring, or thou shalt stand without, and let him go in and bring it out to you. If he's poor, you're not to sleep with his pledge, but rather you're to give it back to him. Now that pledge, in this case, is the outer garment, the coat. And in these times, in those times, and even in New Testament times, people had two basic articles of clothing. They had a garment, and then they had an outer cloak, which they slept in at night. It was their blanket at night. So you took the man's, it's like taking his blanket. Who is it? Snoopy? Snoopy's blanket? Linus's blanket. That's right. Yeah, okay. But you're to give his blanket back. You're not to take it. Verses 14 through 15. You're not to oppress the hired servant that is poor and needy. You're to pay him in his day. When he works, you're to give it, you're to pay him that night so that he can eat. Verse 16, each is responsible for their actions. The father is not to be put to death for the child, nor vice versa. That same thought is going to be picked up again by Ezekiel in the third chapter of his prophecies in the 18th verse, when the ancient seer, it's 18. Chapter 18, verse 19 through 20. The soul that sinneth, it shall die. I'm just going to read verse 20. The son shall not bear the iniquity of the father, neither shall the father bear the iniquity of the son. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon him, and the wickedness of the wicked shall be upon him. Verses 17 through 18. You're not to oppress three groups: the sojourner, the fatherless, we'd call an orphan, or the widow. Now, those are the three groups that are most susceptible to oppression. The sojourner, and that's famous today. If a person's on a trip, you really have to be careful because people will take you for everything you're worth if you don't watch it. Somebody told me the other day about a guy owned a gas station somewhere out in the desert and kept pouring, shoot a little oil in people's alternator. And he was the last gas at the gas station for 75 miles. And they'd, shut their lid and take off and get down the road about 3 miles. Pretty soon that oil would hit in there and just start smoke would come out of there like wild. Well, the only thing they could do is turn around and just hope their car would make it back to that gas station. So they'd go back there and he'd look at it and say, "Oh, it's your alternator." And so he'd take their alternator out and go in and blow it out with an air hose, polish it up a little bit, put it on there and charge him for a new one. And he finally got caught for it. Well, he was taking the sojourner, etc. Verses 19 through 22, the harvest, gleanings. Now, different things are considered here. First of all, the field. If you forget a sheep, you're to leave it. That's for the sojourner, for the fatherless and the widow. When you beat your olive tree, you're not to go over it again. You're just to do it one time. Now, there are going to be a few left, but you leave those. Next, when you gather the grapes, you don't go back and glean it again. And the reason for all this, stated in verse 22, you're to remember that you were a bondman in Egypt. And God called you out. Point number 13, chapter 25, verses 1 through 19. Corporal punishment, Levirate marriage, equity enjoined. Verses 1 through 3, corporal punishment. If you have a controversy between men, they come to judgment. Then the judges are to justify the righteous, condemn the wicked. But if the wicked man be worthy to be beaten, the judge is to call him, cause him to lie down, and he's to be beaten. And the most that can be done, or the greatest, the maximum penalty is 40 stripes, which he is not to succeed or exceed. Do you remember the statement by Paul in 2 Corinthians 11 that he received 39 lashes? You remember how the Jews did it? They hit him 13 times the breast, 13 times on the right side, 13 times on the left side with that thong, that whip. All right, why only 39 times? They were afraid they would exceed the law. Have you ever tried to count to 40, count on 40 pennies? What happens generally? Somewhere in there, you know, you get your mind starts to wander, about 25 or so. And so they were afraid they would miss it. So they said, no more than 39. Verse 4, thou shalt not muzzle the ox when he treadeth out the grain. Where have you heard that before? Or again? 1 Corinthians 9, used by Paul in support of preaching, a pain the preacher. Verses 5 through 10, the Levirate marriage. If a man dies, he has no son, his brother has a responsibility of taking his brother's wife, his sister-in-law, to be his wife and to raise up seed to his brother. If his brother does not want to take that woman to be his wife, then the elders of the city are to call him. She's to go up to the man, or she's to go up to the elders of the city and to tell him that this man refuses to do his duty. So the elders call this man to him, all right? And they ask him about it. And he tells her, plainly, he just tells them then, I like not to take her. And she has the responsibility of going up to him, spitting in his face, and loosening his shoe from off his foot. And from then on, he is to be called the house of him that hath his shoe loose. So you can just call him the loose shoe man. But that's a sign that he did not fulfill his duty as a brother in the Levirate marriage. And do you remember how I told you to remember that Levirate? Now, the two ways you can look at that. That brother, when this law happens, might either just become so mad he'd just be irate, leave irate. Or he might say, irate. Depends on what he thinks of his sister-in-law. Verses 11 through 16, laws of equity. Verses 11 through 12, if a man is beating another man, the wife decides she's going to help her husband. If she takes the other man by his genitals, you're to cut her hand off. You're not to spare because she has desecrated a law of cleanness, of holiness. Verses 13 through 16, you're not to have different types of weights. You know, we have one set of weights for the government officials, and we have another set for our customers, type of an affair. You're to have one standard of weights in your house. Verses 17 through 19, You are to utterly blot out Amalek. He refused to let you pass, or not refused to let you pass, but he came out to meet you. Now, what's this referring back to? What happened? Think. This is one of the first battles. Seems like ages, huh? Okay. What about when Moses held his hands up? All right, who were they fighting? Amalek. Exodus 17. Okay? This is what that has reference back to. Chapter 26. Point number 14, the last point of this section. Thanksgiving and tithes. Verses 1 through 11 are the first fruits. The first four verses deal with the presentation of the first fruits, and then verses 5 through 10 present the accompanying prayer. And I want to read that prayer. When the man brings his first fruits and he lays them down at the priest's feet, and then he is to make this prayer. Assyrian ready to perish was my father, and he went down into Egypt and sojourned there, few in number. How many in number? 70. And he became there a nation, great, mighty, and populous. And the Egyptians dealt ill with us and afflicted us and laid upon us hard bondage. And we cried unto Jehovah, the God of our fathers. Now notice, Assyrian ready to perish was my father. Who is that? Who's Assyrian? Abraham. Or Jacob. Rather. He went down into Egypt. Alright. And so what we've done is we've had Genesis now recapped. And now he's recapping Exodus. And the Egyptians dealt ill with us and inflicted us and laid upon us hard bondage. And we cried unto Jehovah. That's Exodus 1. The God of our fathers. And Jehovah heard our voice. And do you remember this? God calls Moses because he's heard the people's voice and saw our affliction and our toil and our oppression. And Jehovah brought us out forth out of Egypt with a mighty hand and with an outstretched arm and with great terribleness and with signs and with wonders. Now he's gone up through Exodus 15. And he hath brought us unto this place and hath given us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. All right, so he's gone all the way from Exodus, skipped Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and he's coming into Joshua. We haven't quite got there yet. And now, behold, I have brought the first of the fruit of the ground, which thou, O Jehovah, hast given me, and thou shalt set it down before Jehovah thy God and worship before Jehovah thy God. Now, all of this, now that last part, O Jehovah, thou hast given me, period. That ends the prayer. But that is the prayer. So basically, it's a recital of all that God has done. Now, why do that? That's right. It's to bring back to their mind what Jehovah has done for Israel. And then to worship and to rejoice. Verses 12 through 15. Do you remember that we said that every third year they had to bring the tithe? Well, after the tithe was brought, then they were to give the tithe to the Levite, to the sojourner, to the fatherless, to the widow, so that they may eat within thy gates and be filled. So, really, here you have a very real sense of what Paul talks about in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, equality. Do you remember? You give so that there may be equality. The same thing is being stressed here. And you're to say, I have put away the hallowed things out of my house and have also given them unto the Levite and unto the sojourner, to the fatherless, to the widow, according to all thy commandments which thou hast commanded me. I have not transgressed any of thy commandments, neither have I forgotten them. I have not eaten thereof in the morning, neither have I put away thereof, being unclean, nor given thereof for the dead. I have hearkened to the voice of Jehovah my God. I have done according to all that thou hast commanded me. But what's he saying? Well, I've kept this for 3 years. Would you be prone, if you had something for 3 years, maybe to dip and borrow a little bit, returning or intending to return it? But you got into a tight situation. How many of you have done that with money that you're saving for something else, you know? Well, I'll put it back. You had to stand before God and say, I haven't done it. This is it. And what God is saying is, you set it aside for me and you lay it by and it is mine. You don't touch it. verses 16 through 19. The conclusion. Israel is enjoined to keep the covenant. This day Jehovah thy God commandeth thee to do these statutes and ordinances. Thou shalt therefore keep and do them with all thy heart and with all thy soul. Thou hast avouched Jehovah this day to be thy God, that thou wouldest walk in his ways and keep his statutes and his commandments and his ordinances and hearken unto his voice. Now that has been your pledge. What has Jehovah pledged? Jehovah hath avouched thee this day to be a people for his own possession, as he hath promised thee, and that thou shouldest keep all his commandments. Is there a covenant? Yes. What is the covenant? The covenant is that Israel has accepted Jehovah as their God, and God has accepted Israel as his people. As a man pledges himself to his wife, and the wife to her husband, so Jehovah and Israel form and enter into a covenant relationship. The third discourse is from chapters 27 through 30. And I entitle this, The Covenant with God. This discourse may be broken down, as you can see on your outline, into three subsections. Verses 1 through 26 of chapter 27, ratification of the law. Chapter 28, the blessings and curses of the law. Chapters 29 through 30, a renewed declaration of the covenant, blessing and curses declared. First, the ratification of the law. Chapter 27. In verses 1 through 8, we have restated the fact that Israel is to set up those stones at Ebal when they arrive. Now, do you remember we've already had this once? But there are several things about these stones. You're not to hew the stones, or you're not to put a human instrument to them. We've had that stated before. Do you remember the altars? They were to be natural stones. Now notice verse 4. And it shall be when ye are passed over the Jordan that ye shall set up these stones which I command you this day in Mount Ebal, and thou shalt plaster them with plaster, and there shalt thou build an altar in Jehovah thy God, an altar of stones. Thou shalt lift up no iron tool upon them. God made it, and God made it better than man could make it. You leave it alone. You use what God has made to serve God. Verses 9 through 10, admonition or exhortation to keep the law. Keep silence and hearken, O Israel. This day thou art become the people of Jehovah thy God. Thou shalt therefore obey the voice of Jehovah thy God and do his commandments and his statutes which I command thee this day. Have you begun to get the impression that Moses is really interested in impressing these people with the need to keep the law? Just look at how many times that is repeated. Verses 11 through 26, the blessings and the curses. When we introduced the book of Deuteronomy, we said there were two elements in the book. There was a positive and a negative element. The positive element is seen in the blessings. You keep the covenant. Now, what regulates the covenant? Now, the covenant is the relationship between Jehovah, Yahweh, and Israel. The law regulates that covenant. You keep the law. When you break the law, you break the covenant. They're not one and the same thing, but when you break the law, you break the covenant. So that if you break the law, then these curses will come upon you. That's the negative. If you keep it, Jehovah will bless you unbelievably. That is the positive element. So he begins in verses 11 through 12, the positive. And it's interesting to notice how much room is given to which aspect. The negative will always be the heavier. And I think the reason for that is because it's foretelling Israel's history. Now we're going to have, in just a minute, we're going to have chapters 29 through 30, a prophetic view of the rest of Israel's history. All of Old Testament history is going to be summarized in Genesis 29 through 30. But anyway, right here, verse 11 through 12, the blessings. When you come upon Mount Gerizim, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Joseph, and Benjamin are to stand upon the mount, and the blessings are to be read. All right, now, on the other hand, the curses, verses 13 through 26. upon Mount Ebal, Reuben, Gad, Asher, Zebulun, Dan, and Naphtali. The Levites are to answer. So what you had, here are these groups, and the law is being read. Well, when you've got 2.5 million people, you've got to carry some voices quite a way. McGarvey, when he was over there, said that it formed somewhat of a natural amphitheater, and that your voice carries surprisingly well. Well, you can see that the two mountains face each other. So you'd have a little bit of reflection. Your voice would come back to you. It's not just going out and dissipating as it goes out. You have some bounce, some feedback, not so much that it bothers you. But then the Levites also would stand out there. The law would be read, these blessings. The Levites would repeat them. The curses likewise. Well, in particular, the curses, and this is what's specified. The Levites were to cry out with this loud voice, "Cursed be the man that maketh a graven or molten image, an abomination unto Jehovah, the work of the hands of the craftsman, and setteth it up in secret." The people are to say, "Amen," which means so be it. And then again, another curse. "He that setteth light by his father or mother. He that removeth his neighbor's landmark. He that maketh the blind to wander out of the way. Or the one that wresteth justice from those that would be oppressed. That lieth with his father's wife. That lies with any manner of beast. That lies with his sister. That lies with his mother-in-law. That smiteth his neighbor in secret. That takes a bribe to slay an innocent person. That confirms not the word to the laws to keep them." And the people are to say, "Amen." Now what are they doing? They're ratifying the covenant. They're ratifying the law. You see, the law is announced and the people says, "That's the way it's going to be." And what they're doing, in effect, is sealing their own doom because they're not going to keep the law. Chapter 28, the blessings and the curses. The first 14 verses, the blessings. "And it shall come to pass, if thou shalt hearken diligently unto the voice of Jehovah thy God, and observe to do all his commandments which I command thee this day, that Jehovah thy God will set thee on high above all the nations of the earth. And all these blessings shall come upon thee and overtake thee, if thou shalt hearken unto the voice of Jehovah thy God." And now in verses 3 through 5 or 6, he describes the blessings that are going to come upon them. And notice, even the enemies to be smitten, verse 7. "Your barns, whatever you put your hand to do, will prosper." As our idiom, it will, anything he touches turns to gold, is the equivalent that we have. Verse 10, "All the peoples of the earth will see that you're called by Jehovah's name and they're going to fear you. You will be plentiful. Jehovah will open up unto thee his good treasure, the heavens. The rain is to come upon the land. You're to lend to the nations, but not to borrow." And again, Israel is simply to be exalted. But, verse 15, through the end of the chapter, the curses. "It shall come to pass, if thou wilt not hearken unto the voice of Jehovah thy God, to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes, which I command thee this day, that all these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee." Now you just mark this down, because you're reading Israel's history. "Cursed shalt thou be in the city, and cursed shalt thou be in the field." Namely, what he's saying is cursed, you're going to be cursed wherever you're at. "Cursed shall be thy basket and thy kneading trough. Cursed shall be the fruit of thy blood and the fruit of thy ground, the increase of thy cattle and the young of thy flock, every offspring. Cursed shalt thou be when thou comest in. Cursed shalt thou be when thou goest out." Wherever you go, whenever you go, you're going to be cursed. Now those are the generals. The specifics now. The specifics are to come in the forms of some of the diseases. Notice verse 21. "Jehovah will make the pestilence cleave unto thee, until he have consumed thee from off the land whither thou goest in to possess it. Jehovah will smite thee with consumption, with fever, and with inflammation, with fiery heat, and with the sword, and with blasting, with the mildew, and they shall pursue thee until thou perish." All of these diseases. Do you remember any covenant that God had made with Israel concerning the diseases of Egypt in particular? You remember in Exodus 15, God said, now this is right after they crossed the Red Sea, if you'll keep my covenant, I'll spare you from any of those diseases. You break it, and I'll smite you with them. That's the implication there. Now they're going to be smitten with diseases. Heaven shall be brass, which suggests what? Did it click? Did it go off? I think he's coming back on. Heaven shall be brass. Suggests what? No rain. Brass is metal. Metal doesn't rain. Doesn't rain from metal. And with the idea, it's completely shut up. The earth that shall be under thee shall be iron. What do you plow in iron? Pretty rough to plant seeds in it, isn't it? Jehovah will make the rain of thy land powder and dust. Remember the Dust Bowl in America? All right, that's what God is promising them. From heaven it shall come down upon thee until thou be destroyed. The enemies, thou shalt go one way out against them and shalt flee seven ways before them. So you have the picture. Here's the army going out. They meet in battle and everybody just turns and runs however they think they can get away. Your dead bodies are going to be food for the birds of the heaven, for the ravens, for the vultures. Jehovah will smite thee with the boil of Egypt, and with the emerods, and with the scurvy, and with the itch, wherefore, whereof thou canst not be healed. That's what I was thinking of, Exodus 15. There's your allusion. The boils of Egypt. The boil of Egypt. How about the plague? The boils. You're to be smitten with madness. Notice all of this description of these things. And then in verse 30, thou shalt betroth a wife, and another man shall lie with her. You're going to build a house, but you won't live in it. You'll plant a vineyard, but you won't use the fruit. Your own ox, your own animals will be slain before your eyes. Your sons and your daughters will be given to another people, and you'll stand there and with longing eyes watch them go off, never to see them again. Then you're to be brought, and a king whom thou shalt set over thee unto a nation that thou hast not known. You're going into captivity. Verse 36. You're to become an astonishment, a proverb, and a byword among all the peoples. And there you're going to plant vineyards, but you're not going to drink. You'll have olive trees, but you're not going to anoint yourself with its oil. You're going to begat sons and daughters, but they're going into captivity. You get the idea that God's going to smite them with some discomfiture? Going on down now in this, there's a particular point. Verse 49. Jehovah will bring a nation against thee from far, from the end of the earth, as the eagle flieth. A nation whose tongue thou shalt not understand. A nation of fierce countenance that shall not regard the person of the old, nor show favor to the young, and shall eat the fruit of thy cattle and the fruit of thy ground until thou shalt be destroyed, that also shall not leave thee grain, new wine, or oil, the increase of thy cattle, or young of thy flock, until they have caused thee to perish. Assyria is described just like that in the 10th chapter of Isaiah. The rod of Jehovah's anger. And it's also to a foreign nation, when Isaiah talks about that they're going to teach you with an unknown tongue. Do you remember that? Now that's quoted over in 1 Corinthians 11. That's also taken from Isaiah. And the point there, that's in Isaiah 28, is that Israel would not listen to the word of God, so he's going to teach them by men. You won't understand their speech. They'll have a foreign tongue to you, but you will understand their sword. The tongue isn't the method, isn't the means or the method of communication. The sword is. That you will understand. So again, what I want you to see is how what is being said here, these are the seeds that the prophets are going to pick up, and you're going to see them again and again in Old Testament prophets. here's really a sad description. Verse 54 and following. The man that is tender among you and very delicate, his eye shall be evil towards his brother, and toward the wife of his bosom, and toward the remnant of his children whom he hath remaining, so that he will not give to any of them of the flesh of his children whom he shall eat, because he hath nothing left him in the siege and in the distress wherewith thine enemy shall distress thee in all thy gates. The tender and delicate woman among you, the same thing. That happened three times in Israel's history. One time Hezekiah was walking along the wall, and two women were talking about eating a son. Again, when Jerusalem was finally destroyed in 586, people ate their own children. And in 70 AD, Josephus records an instance of people eating their own children. Notice verse 58, if thou wilt not observe to do all the words of this law that are written in this book, that thou mayest fear this glorious and fearful name, Jehovah thy God, then Jehovah will make thy plagues wonderful. And he goes on to describe, verse 60, the diseases of Egypt are to come upon you. All of these things, Israel, and you can read the rest, but you've gotten the picture. The final section in this last sermon, chapters 29 through 30, actually, although I've captioned it, a renewed declaration of the covenant, deals with the future of Israel's history. In the first 13 verses of chapter 29, the covenant is renewed. You'll notice, well, verse 1 is an introduction. These are the words of the covenant which Jehovah commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab, besides the covenant which he made with them in Horeb. Now, where's Horeb? Sinai. That's the original covenant. Okay? This is a renewed declaration. Moses calls him in verses 2 through 9. He recalls the events that have transpired up until this time. All of the things that Jehovah did in Egypt for Israel. The wilderness wanderings, your clothes have not fallen off you. Your shoes, it has not waxed old upon your foot. You've defeated people in battle. Now, with that in mind, keep the words of this covenant. Verses 10 through 13, the covenant is renewed. Ye stand this day, all of you, before Jehovah your God, your heads and your tribes, your elders and your officers, even all the men of Israel, your little ones, your wives, and thy sojourner that is in the midst of thy camps, from the hewer of thy wood unto the drawer of thy water, that thou mayest enter into the covenant. Now, you see, what he's saying is, this isn't just the heads of the tribes that are entering this. Now, the people might think that. Later, they get down along the line somewhere and they say, well, we didn't enter that. No, the princes of Israel, the judges got together and they made that agreement, not us. Moses says it is everyone, from the least to the greatest, that thou mayest enter into the covenant of Jehovah thy God and into his oath, which Jehovah thy God maketh with thee this day, that he may establish this day unto himself for a people, and that he may become unto thee a God as he spake unto thee, and as he sware unto thy fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Verses 14 through chapter 30, verse 14, the future of Israel. First, under this section or subsection, another smaller section, verses 14 through 21, a warning. Basically, the warning, you've heard it before. You've got to keep the law or else. Notice, he reminds him, let me begin in verse 16. For ye know how we dwelt in the land of Egypt, and how we came through the midst of the nations through which we passed. And ye have seen their abominations and their idols, wood and stone, silver and gold, which were among them. Now, when I read that statement, I think of Isaiah 44 and the description of the idols of wood that Israel will later fall prey to. Lest there should be among you man or woman or family or tribe whose heart turneth away this day from Jehovah our God, to go to serve the gods of those nations. Now you've seen it, you've seen the fallacy of it. Learn your lesson, Israel. And it shall come to pass, verse 19, when he heareth the words of this curse, that he bless himself in his heart, saying, I shall have peace, though I walk in the stubbornness of my heart to destroy the moist with the dry. Jehovah will not pardon him. But then the anger of Jehovah and his jealousy will smoke against that man. And all the curse that is written in this book shall lie upon him, and Jehovah will blot out his name from under heaven. The man that raises himself up and says, I've heard the curse, but I'm safe. I don't have anything to worry about. Moses is very graphic. He says, the wrath of God is going to smoke against the man. And you can just see the flames. Verses 22 through 29. The result of violating the covenant seen through the eyes of future generations. And what this is saying is, Israel, you're not going to keep the covenant. Even though you've had all of these warnings, I've told you repeatedly, keep the covenant. If you don't, these curses will come upon you. You're not going to do it. And so this is what future generations are going to, this is what they'll have to say about you. And the generation to come, your children that shall rise up after you, and the foreigner that shall come from a far land shall say, when they shall see the plagues of that land and the sicknesses wherewith Jehovah hath made it sick, and that the whole land thereof is a brimstone and salt and a burning, that it is not sown nor beareth nor any grass groweth therein, like the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah and Zeboiim, which Jehovah overthrew in his anger and his wrath. Even all the nations shall say, wherefore hath Jehovah done this unto the land? What meaneth the heat of this great anger? Then the men shall say, because they forsook the covenant of Jehovah, the God of their fathers, which he made with them when he brought them forth out of the land of Egypt. They're going to know, Israel. They're going to realize that you made a commitment and that you failed to keep it. And they're going to look upon you with shame and with contempt for your breach of faithfulness. Chapter 30, verses 1 through 14. Israel's return to Jehovah and the covenant, and consequently to the land. Basically what happens is this. Israel rejects Jehovah. Jehovah therefore rejects Israel. Israel must come back to Jehovah. Israel will come back to Jehovah, and when she does, Jehovah will come back to Israel. And the first time in the process of rejection, God vomits Israel out of the land. When Israel comes back to accept Jehovah and Jehovah accepts Israel, God brings Israel back to the land. And that's this latter half that we have described here. In verses 1 through 10, the power of repentance is described. And it shall come to pass, when all these things are come upon thee, the blessing and the curse which I have set before thee, and thou shalt call them to mind among all the nations whither Jehovah thy God hath driven thee, and shalt return unto Jehovah thy God, and shalt obey his voice according to all that I command thee this day, thou and thy children with all thy heart and with all thy soul, that then Jehovah thy God will turn thy captivity and have compassion upon thee, and will return and gather thee from all the peoples whither Jehovah thy God hath scattered thee. That happened three times. The first time it happened was when Jehovah destroyed, actually, the setting of it, how it all begins. In 539 B.C., Jehovah destroys Babylon through the hand of the Medo-Persian Empire. Cyrus comes to power, and in 536, the proclamation goes forth that any who have been in Babylonian captivity can return to their land. Now, that declaration is recorded in the last chapter of 2 Chronicles. In 536 B.C., the first group of captives returned to the land under Zerubbabel and who else? I've forgotten. Second date is 458 B.C. This time, isn't it Nehemiah that leads them? And then 444 B.C., Esther. Or not Esther, Ezra. I may have Ezra and Nehemiah mixed up. I haven't looked at those for several years. But basically, in these first 10 verses, this is your point. That Israel's repenting, they're coming back to God. And God is going to bring them back. And notice verse 6. And Jehovah thy God will circumcise thy heart and the heart of thy seed to love Jehovah thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul, that thou mayest live. Now look, God has circumcised the heart. That's what Paul is talking about in Romans, the second chapter, when he says, a Jew is not one who is circumcised outwardly, but inwardly, a true Jew. It is a circumcision of the heart, of the hardening. And see, circumcision is just a cutting off or a cutting around. That's literally what the term means. The Greek word just means a cutting around. Well, it's a cutting around the heart of all the hardness that Israel had built up. And then, God says, when that's happened, I'm going to turn these curses that I've placed upon you and turn them upon the enemies of you. In verses 11 through 14, for this commandment which I command thee this day, it is not too hard for thee, neither is it far off. And when it says far off, that means it's hard. All right? It is not in heaven that thou shouldest say, who shall go up for us to heaven and bring it unto us and make us to hear it that we may do it. Neither is it beyond the sea that thou shouldest say, who shall go over the sea for us and bring it unto us and make us to hear it that we may do it. But the word is very nigh unto thee, in thy mouth and in thy heart, that thou mayest do it. Now I notice Rudy has already turned to the New Testament. Where are you looking? Are you looking at that in the New Testament? Oh, okay. Well, keep going in Romans. And look at Romans verses, chapter 10, verse 8. But what saith it? The word is nigh thee, in thy mouth and in thy heart. That is, it is accessible to you. Now keep going in your New Testament and flip on over to Ephesians, the fourth chapter. No, wait, let's see. No, that's not right. That's close to it. But there's another one that I'm thinking of. There's a passage in the New Testament that says the same thing. It's quoting this. Maybe it's back in Romans. I can't remember. This statement is applied to Christ. Boy, oh boy. What's the matter with me? I just assumed that I could remember that. Well, I guess just Romans 10, 6 through 8. Well, there it is. Yeah, I just didn't back up far enough. Dummy. Who shall ascend into heaven, that is to bring Christ down? Or who shall descend into the abyss, that is to bring Christ up from the dead? But what saith it? The word is nigh thee in thy mouth. There. Okay. So there it's applied to Christ. So just keep that in mind then. Verses 15 through 20. Now actually, this is the final exhortation of Moses. In some ways, it is proper to say these are... the final words. Is this yours or mine? Oh. And basically what these words are is, this is your choice, Israel. And the choice is that between life and death. See, I have set before thee this day life and good, death and evil. In that I command thee this day to love Jehovah thy God, to walk in his ways and to keep his commandments and his statutes and his ordinances, that thou mayest live and multiply, and that Jehovah thy God may bless thee in the land whither thou goest in to possess it. But if thy heart turn away, and thou wilt not hear, but shall be drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I denounce unto you this day that ye shall surely perish. Ye shall not prolong your days in the land whither thou passest over the Jordan to go in to possess it. I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day that I have set before thee life and death, the blessing and the curse. Therefore choose life that thou mayest live, thou and thy seed, to love Jehovah thy God, to obey his voice, and to cleave unto him, for he is thy life and the strength of thy days, that thou mayest dwell in the land which Jehovah sware unto thy fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give them. Deuteronomy affirms, Israel, here is your choice. The difference is life and death. It is blessing and cursing, or curses. Choose you, and Moses says, choose life. The final events are recorded in the last chapters. The final arrangements, chapter 31, this is very easy. Verses 1 through 8, Joshua is appointed. And we've known that this would be right. Notice verse 6, or this would happen. Verse 6, be strong and of good courage. Fear not, nor be affrighted at them. For Jehovah thy God, he it is that doth go with thee. He will not fail thee nor forsake thee. And then Moses charges Joshua this. In verses 9 through 13, the law is to be read every 7 years. This fact is brought out and stressed. In verses 14 through 23, Joshua is commissioned and Moses is instructed to write a song. And the song that Moses is instructed to write is to be a witness against the children of Israel. We're going to deal with that song in just a minute. And verses 24 through 30, the law that Moses writes in these books is to be placed beside the ark. That's in verse 26 in particular. Now in chapter 32, the song. The song is in the first 47 verses, and we may divide the song into these different categories. The first 3 verses are introductory. Give ear, ye heavens, and I will speak. And let the earth hear the words of my mouth. You can see that. And notice verse 3. For I will proclaim the name of Jehovah. Ascribe ye greatness unto our God. In verses 4 through 6, the theme of the song is introduced, and the theme is the faithfulness of the rock, Jehovah. The rock, his work is perfect, for all his ways are justice, a God of faithfulness and without iniquity. Just and right is he. You see the emphasis there. Verses 7 through 14, Jehovah's past treatment of Israel, her exaltation. Remember the days of old, consider the years of many generations. Ask thy father, and he will show thee, thine elders, and they will tell thee. When the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the children of men, he set the bounds of the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel. Now, I find that statement very interesting. How many nations were recorded in Genesis 10? 70. How many people went into Egypt? 70. Now that rang a bell when I read that verse. He set the bounds of the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel. That's just a thought. There may a connection may be intended there. Verse 9. For Jehovah's portion is his people. Jacob is the lot of his inheritance. Now that thought is reintroduced in the New Testament. That the saints are God's inheritance. That's stated in the first chapter of Ephesians. It's stated again in the New Testament. But basically, in these verses, you have the picture of Israel as she is exalted by Jehovah. But in verses 15 through 18, Israel's rebellion. But Jeshurun waxed fat and kicked. Thou art waxed fat, thou art grown thick, thou art become sleek. Then he forsook God who made him and lightly esteemed the rock of his salvation. the strange gods in verse 16. They sacrificed unto demons, which were no God, verse 17. Verse 19 through 35, Jehovah's judgment brought upon Israel. You see what you have? In this, you actually have this song is a record of Israel's history. God chose Israel. He brought them. First, you have Jehovah's faithfulness introduced. Then the exaltation of Israel. Then the rebellion, and now God is smiting Israel. Verses 19 through 35. And Jehovah sought and abhorred them because of the provocation of his sons and his daughters. And he said, I will hide my face from them. I will see what their end shall be, for they are a very perverse generation. And then he says, I will move them to jealousy with those that are not a people. I will provoke them with a foolish nation. And he describes the things that he is going to bring upon them. Then in verses 35 through 43, Jehovah's mercy is extended to Israel and his vengeance upon their enemies, or her enemies. Vengeance is mine and recompense. Remember Paul's statement in Romans 13, vengeance is mine, thus saith the Lord. Or vengeance is mine, I will recompense, thus saith the Lord. Here it is. And you have, again, just Israel is to be blessed. And you'll notice verse 41, I will render vengeance to mine adversaries and will recompense that hate them that hate me. I will make mine arrows drunk with blood. And then notice, with the blood of the slain and the captives from the head of the leaders of the enemy, he's going to avenge. Expiation for land, his land, and for his people. In verses 44 through 52, we have the final, or the epilogue to the chapter. The final charge in verses 44 through 47 of Moses. He finishes all these words in verse 46. Set your heart unto all the words which I testify unto you this day, which ye command your children to observe to do, even all the words of this law. For it is no vain thing for you, because it is your life. And through this thing ye shall prolong your days in the land whither ye go over the Jordan to possess it. And then God says, Moses, get up on Nebo, and there you're going to die. In the 33rd chapter, we have the blessings of Moses upon Israel. And very briefly, this can be broken down into four points. Verses 1 through 5 are an introduction. Verses 6 through 25, the blessings upon the tribes. And then you just have the tribes in this order. Verse 6, Reuben. Verse 7, Judah. Verses 8 through 11, Levi. Verse 12, Benjamin. Verses 13 through 17, Joseph. 18 through 19, Zebulun. 20 through 21, Gad. 22, Dan. 23, Naphtali. 24, Asher. Now what you can do, you can just go in your Bible and you can just read those, do the same thing I did. That's all, I just took them right out. But there's one thing that's very significant about all of this. Towards the end of the lives of the patriarchs, do you remember that they would give blessings? Isaac extended blessings when he was about to die. Remember that? And mistakenly to Jacob instead of Esau, and then partially to Esau. Who else did that? Not Joseph. Jacob, Genesis 49, upon all Israel. So now as Moses dies, he's doing the same thing, and especially the same thing that Jacob did. Because Jacob takes every son. Moses is just taking the tribes, which are the descendants of the sons, and doing that. Then notice in verses 26 through 29, the conclusion of this, and the final blessing. There is none like unto God, O Jeshurun, who rideth upon the heavens for thy help, and in his excellency on the skies. The eternal God is thy dwelling place, and underneath are the everlasting arms. And he thrust out the enemy from before thee, and said, Destroy. Those two verses are a picture of the mighty Jehovah of Israel. In verses 28 through 29, Moses says, Israel, you are so very blessed because Jehovah is your God. And Israel dwelleth in safety, the fountain of Jacob alone, in a land of grain and new wine, yea, his heavens drop down dew. Happy art thou, O Israel, who is like unto thee, a people saved by Jehovah. The shield of thy help and the sword of thy excellency. And thine enemies shall submit themselves unto thee, and thou shalt tread upon their high places. And then Moses began his ascent of Mount Nebo to the top of Pisgah. God allowed Moses to see the entire land. And as we observe Sunday night in the sermon, I think that in this chapter, you have several of the characteristics of God revealed. You have the mercy of God. It is God's mercy that allows Moses to see all of the land. It is the justice of God, in that God, because he is just, cannot allow Moses, who has sinned, to enter the land. And it is the faithfulness of God that has brought the people to this land and now is ready to lead them into it. And all three of those characteristics or those attributes are prominent in this chapter. Moses has not lost his strength. He still has all the power. And so his death is not simply that he's going up there and dying of old age, but I really believe the text indicates that God is, in effect, is taking his life. Not that God just smote him dead, but that he's relinquishing his life, and it's a blessing. And one of the highest things that can be said about Moses, I want you to notice this. In look at verse 4. And Jehovah said unto him, this is the land which I swear unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob, saying, I will give it unto thy seed, and have caused thee to see it with thine eyes, but thou shalt not go over thither. You think about the emotions of Moses' heart as he viewed that land. He'd looked for it for 40 years, and all of the complaining, all of the bickering. So Moses, the servant of Jehovah, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of Jehovah. And he buried him in the valley in the land of Moab, over against Beth Peor. God buried him. No man made the grave of Moses. But no man knoweth of the sepulchre unto this day. Joshua is appointed. Verse 9. He's full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands upon him. That's an interesting phrase. Laid his hands upon him, had the spirit of wisdom. Kind of sounds like Acts 8. But now notice the final summation of Moses, verses 10 and following. And there hath not arisen a prophet since in Israel like unto Moses, whom Jehovah knew face to face, in all the signs and wonders which Jehovah sent him to do in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh and to all his servants and to all his land, and in all the mighty hand, and in all the great terror which Moses wrought in the sight of Israel. None like unto him, until the prophet whereof Moses spake, the Lord God shall raise up one unto you from among your brethren like unto me. To him shall you hearken unto all things whatsoever he shall speak unto you. And it shall be that every soul that shall not hearken to that prophet shall be utterly destroyed from among the people. That prophet is Christ Jesus. Sometimes people say, well, did Moses write Deuteronomy 34? Well, he could have. Probably not. Probably somebody appended it to it. Moses had wrote almost all of it, but Moses is definitely the author of the Pentateuch. There's no question about that. Do you all have any questions? Next year, next September, we begin in Joshua, the conquest of the land. And if you think that we've had a lot of material this time, next time we have even more. Esther. All the way up to Job. And what I would like to try and do in that course is to incorporate the place of the prophets, how each prophet fits in. What I want to do with the course next time is the same thing that we do with Acts in the New Testament. Okay? Now that's my idea. This would be almost like equivalent to the Gospels in a very real way. And the next time, that will be sort of similar to Acts. And then when you study the prophets, that's like studying the epistles. That type of an approach. So I think next time, you had to have had Deuteronomy, you had to have the Pentateuch before you can appreciate the history. Because this is the law. This is what it's all about. This is what the prophets keep going back to time and time again. And the book of Deuteronomy is so important when you study the prophets because, as I've tried to emphasize, they come back and pick up these seeds and develop them in their sermons from Moses. So I think you'll really enjoy it. And again, try and read that book this summer. I plan to try and read it this summer. I read up through, I don't remember how far. I haven't looked at it in a couple of months, just to be frank. I've been disappointed in that book. It's just too brief. And so the next time, if I teach this course, if I ever teach this course again, I would not use the same book for a textbook. Bill might not like that since he's got a stack of them in there. I don't know. But anyway, I like Smith's Old Testament history that we're using on Sunday morning much better. And that's just my personal preference. I just think it deals with it a lot more in detail. And I think maybe that next time, instead of using that, we might try and find something different. Or a good commentary on the Pentateuch that's not so long that you have to read 3,000 pages, you know, something like that. Okay, I really enjoyed it. I hope you all got a lot out of it. And have a real good summer, and be looking to see you next September.